together under everybody's nose. The Carlyle Group, since years before, still raking in billions and itching for more. It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war, we say code pink. It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war, we say code pink. Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink till hunger and war have ceased. Code pink for women, all genders and girls. Together we'll make peace. This was Obama really the hero they
That
say?
Was Code Pink by Emma's Revolution. I am Danica from Code Pink. Welcome to our Code Pink radio show presented by WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and many other community radio stations like Western Mass Community Broadcasting, WMCBLP 107.9 FM. We're also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You could check out our website at codepink.org/radio, where you can find all of our episodes from episode one to our most recent. I am really honored to be joined by our guest today, Dr. Aisha Juman, from who is the founder and president of Yemen Relief and Reconstruction Foundation, Jehan Hakim, the chair of Yemeni Alliance Committee, and Dr. Shireen Aladimi, the assistant professor at Michigan State University and non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute. I'm super honored to have these guests today because we'll be talking about Yemen. I put out on my Twitter last week, if you have any questions about Yemen, I'm interviewing three amazing Yemeni women and experts on the issue. Earlier this week, the Biden administration announced that we had troops on the ground in Yemen from the United States. And for weeks, the U.S. has resumed airstrikes in Yemen in response to the Houthis blocking ships destined for Israel with the demand that Israel stop its genocide in Gaza. So thank you to all three of you for being here. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure.
We have some... Oh, first I want to plug Code Pink and Yemen Relief and Reconstruction Foundation did a series together years ago called Beyond the War, where we brought Yemeni artists, architects, storytellers, and more to come on to teach people a little bit more about Yemen. I really do encourage people to check that out. There is going to be, in the next weeks and months, sort of an onslaught of disinformation about Yemen, so it'd be good to learn more about the country, especially as Americans, so please check it out. Just to sort of get started, could you each tell the listeners a bit about where you and your families are from, or something special with the cities that you're from, or something that you look forward to when you go back next time?
I'm going to start on that. So I'm from Rada', which is a city about 200 kilometers out of south of Sana'a. And growing up, there were a lot of stories, Yemeni love stories, and every day you'll hear multiple stories, even teaching us about faith. It was always done through stories. But one story I think is quite interesting is there is another area within Rada', it's called Al-Arsh. And Al-Arsh means the throne. And local legends in Yemen say that it's called the throne or Al-Arsh because that's where King Solomon met with the Queen of Sheba, Bilqis. And that's why this area is called the Al-Arsh. And the logic behind it was that when the hobo, the bird, you know, went from King Solomon's to Yemen, where he found that they were worshiping the sun, he went in the morning and came back in the evening. So he could not have been possibly flown to Palestine, from Palestine to Yemen in one day, coming back. So I just want to share that because I think it's quite intriguing.
That's a lovely story. And I am from Aden and from Taiz. So my father's family is from Taiz, but I haven't spent too much time there, unfortunately, other than, of course, visiting family, grandparents. But my mom's family is from Aden, and I was born in Aden. And one interesting story, well, I guess it's in the name. So Aden used to be occupied by the British, and you know, for 129 years. But there's this one region in Aden, it's called in Arabic, Crater, which is the English word crater. And it's because the entire part of that city, it's like a smaller city within Aden, the entirety of it is in an old volcanic crater. And so when you go there, when you drive there, the entire place is surrounded by mountains. And in fact, during the war, we went there for safety because it's the safest place to be in Aden, surrounded by mountains. But to just literally be like a city growing out of this ancient volcanic crater and to retain that name in English, I always found that fascinating.
Wow, you guys have amazing stories. Well, my family's from a city called Ibb. IBB, it's still part of the north, considered part of the north. It's about 100-ish miles south of Sana'a. And then I think it's like less than 100 miles or about 100 miles from Mocha or Machat, where everybody gets their coffee from. And Ibb is actually known as, and you know, maybe others on the line may disagree with me, but Ibb is known for being the most greenest city in Yemen because of all the water. It is just like super beautiful. And for those who like live in the Bay, the weather is very similar to the Bay. It's very just mild full of, you know, greenery. So I remember I lived in Ibb about a year and some change when I was a teenager. And I loved being around all the green and all the scenery. I remember a life that was happy, to be honest with you. That's what I remember and miss the most is that was the sound of kids playing in the streets. And there was like a level of safety that I am not seeing a lot of Yemeni children, including my family members, experiencing right now.
Thank you to all three of you. And I just to riff off Jahan a little bit, Palestine also has the same biome as California. So there's just a lot of the same geographical features that like might feel familiar between the two. So I think that's a good baseline to start off. And I wanted this to be sort of like an all-encompassing sort of introductory interview, because I think, you know, people may have been familiar with U.S. involvement in Yemen a few years ago, and then they stopped hearing about it as much. And it just might be confusing to pick up from where they left off. So I think is it okay if I just field these questions to like one of you at a time? Okay. So in simple terms, I'll give this to Shireen. In simple terms, why is the United States bombing Yemen at this current moment?
Bab el-Mandeb Strait. That's the simplest thing. And it's actually the same reason, I would argue, that it has been bombing Yemen since 2015. People have often asked me, and Danica, you were in a presentation that I did years and years ago in the Chicago area where we first met. But you'd remember maybe the slide that I always showed about why is the U.S. involved in Yemen. And I always had Bab el-Mandeb Strait there because the question was, why is the U.S. and Saudi, why are they interested in Yemen? Yemen is impoverished. Yemen is, you know, doesn't really, it's, you know, it's not an OPEC country. Of course, there are significant gas and oil, you know, reserves that have yet to be explored in some area and have been explored in others. But the main reason is the strategic location of Yemen at the Horn of Africa, controlling Bab el-Mandeb Strait, where global shipping goes through, essentially. So the Suez Canal, anything going through the Suez Canal has to go through Yemen either first or next. So that means shipping from Asia to Europe and North America, you know, shortcut. Or anything from Europe to Asia, Africa has to go through Yemen for a shortcut. Otherwise, you got to go through the Horn of Africa and adds to the shipping costs. It adds to the time couple of weeks time traveling through those areas. So since people care about oil products going through and people care about, you know, our Amazon packages being delivered on time, Yemen plays a strategic role in that area. Why all of a sudden did that become important? It was always important, but the government in Yemen were for decades allies of the United States and allies of Saudi Arabia. So there was never this threat of, well, you know, they've kept Yemen underdeveloped, of course, but there wasn't this threat that they would cause disruption to oil shipping or, you know, global shipping. When the Ansarullah, or as they're known as the Houthis, became powerful in late 2014 and the years preceding that, Saudi Arabia and the United States and the United Arab Emirates panicked, essentially, because if they're going to have somebody in power in Yemen who is not just not loyal to them, but is explicitly anti-Zionist, anti-Saudi, and anti-US, I mean, it's in their slogan, all three of these things, then it would pose a threat to their rule. It would pose a threat to their control over that area. And so they intervened in a civil conflict and turned it into this world's largest humanitarian crisis.
Thank you. That's really helpful. And I do remember that slide. I think about it all the time. And when I'm talking just generally with people and organizations about Yemen, I feel like no one really knows what the Bab al-Mandeb Strait is. Like we had a press conference in Chicago the morning after the U.S. started bombing Yemen, or 2 days after. And we're talking about the Red Sea, and I was like, I know, Shireen's got me. I have the receipts. I have the names. I don't know who to field this question to, and I think I'm going to merge two questions here. So the question is, who are the Houthis, for people who don't know? And I think there's a confusion, you know, between the U.S. talking about the government of Yemen and what they mean by that, and how people in Yemen understand the government of Yemen. I know it's only audio. For the listeners, I am doing air quotes around the government of Yemen. Any of you can take this. So who are the Houthis or Ansarullah, and how can you explain U.S. officials are talking about when they differentiate the Houthis and the Yemeni government, and what is the difference?
Shireen, can you take that and I'll add to it?
Of course. So Ansarullah movement began in the late 90s, early 2000s, and they call themselves Ansarullah. The reason they're known as the Houthis is because their founder's name was Hussein Badruddin al-Houthi. And so it was a family of scholars turned politicians who came from northern Yemen, in the northernmost province in Yemen called Sa'da, which borders Saudi Arabia. And they became prominent during this time for being outspoken against the President Saleh's regime at the time. Not because, you know, just plain old dictatorship, but they had very specific concerns about his regime. So he was known for, you know, enriching himself at the expense of the Yemeni population. So the corruption was one of the reasons that they were vocal against him. But because they come from a family of religious scholars who follow the Zaydi school of thought, which is, again, not a minoritized group in Yemen, because 40% of the population of Yemen approximately follows that, including ex-President Saleh. But he allowed Saudi religious interference in Yemen to go unchecked. So in the 90s, when I was in school in Yemen, I remember even the books, when they stopped being printed in Egypt and in Yemen, and they became, you know, the new prints that we received in 94, 95, 96 were printed in Saudi Arabia. And so much of the encroachment of Wahhabi or Salafi Islam, which the Saudis exported to Yemen, to Bangladesh, to Pakistan, to Afghanistan, all over the world, was corroding the theological fabric of Yemeni society. And so we even saw entire tribes convert to Salafi Islam or Sunni Islam. And so there was this opposition to allowing that kind of influence in Yemen. And the other thing they railed against was U.S. interference in Yemen, whether it was Bush or later Obama. You know, drone warfare was common in Yemen. In the name of fighting terror, they were just coming in and assassinating whoever they thought was a terrorist, breaching Yemeni sovereignty. And so these two issues became what they were speaking out against, and they formed a political party, and they were members of parliament. They lost their seats in parliament at some point, and Saleh started a war against them, because if you pose a threat to a dictator, then he responds by force. So between 2004 and 2010, he fought six different wars with the Houthis. In that time, they organized themselves as, in response to Saleh's attacks. He enlisted Saudi Arabia in those fights, and the movement only just grew from there. So they started off as, you know, speaking out against his policies, against U.S. and foreign intervention, essentially, and then built a movement around that called Ansarullah.
Yeah, thank you very much, Shireen. I'd like just to add a few things. When they started as a believing youth movement, and it was to counter the Wahhabi spread in Yemen. And Saudi Arabia built the largest Salafi Wahhabi university in the whole world, in their area, in Sada. So they were trying to stamp out the Zaydi theology from Yemen by establishing this university in their homeland. The second point that also Shireen talked about is their fierce rejection to U.S. interference in Yemen, and not just in Yemen, but also in the Middle East. So the very first war and confrontation with Ali Abdullah Saleh was actually related to the Iraq War, because Yemen in 2003, and the government in Yemen, headed by Ali Abdullah Saleh at that point in time, supported the Iraq War, and they opposed the Iraq War. And that led to the very first clashes between them and the Yemeni government. And the Saudis supported the Yemeni government in fighting against them.
Thank you. So when the U.S. refers to, right now, like U.S. officials refer to the Houthis and then the government of Yemen, what do they mean by that?
Okay. So what they mean by that is that they took the Houthi, they continue to classify the Houthis as rebels. You'll often hear Iran-backed Houthi rebels, as though these four words cannot be separated when anybody in media speaks about them. So they think of them as just a rebel group who ousted the former president, referring to the events in late 2014, early 2015. What happened was in 2011, the whole Yemeni population rose up against Ali Abdullah Saleh and his regime and the entire government. That revolution, peaceful revolution, was co-opted by different armed groups, allies of Saleh, who turned against him. He finally stepped down, he resigned, and handed over the presidency temporarily to his vice president in 2012. That man, Hadi, despite having outlived his term in parliament and as the interim president, despite having resigned a couple of times, is still somehow considered the internationally recognized president of Yemen from 2015 or from 2012, essentially, all the way to 2022. What happened in 2022 is that the Saudis woke him up from a hotel in Riyadh, told him to step aside, and they were going to replace him by a coalition, a presidential council, essentially, made up of four men who are backed and loyal to Saudi Arabia, and the four others who are backed and loyal to the United Arab Emirates, and they formed the so-called presidential council. They're essentially a war council, because most of them are warlords who have been fighting on the ground, fighting the Houthis. Well, they spent 2022 and the rest of 2023 fighting one another, because their goals are different. Some are separatists, some are Salafis, some are Republicans. But they somehow also inherited the term the internationally recognized government. Nobody recognized them, but it's just that because Hadi was recognized and because the U.S. recognizes him as the president, his handover to power to this council of eight men automatically means, and we're supposed to just go with this, the rest of the world, that they are the internationally recognized government in Yemen, even though most of them are not even based in Yemen. And the Houthis, despite being the de facto government in the north, where 80% of the population resides, they're still thought of or spoken about as though they're a fringe rebel group, and, you know, which betrays either a lack of understanding of what's happening on the ground, or more likely just a nefarious kind of obfuscation of facts.
Excellent, Shireen. I'd like just to add a few points here. Some people refer to the internationally recognized government as the legitimate government of Yemen. And that is, legitimacy comes from the population. It does not come from the international community. So I think the correct term is the internationally recognized government, which is actually a sad reality, because they're not, you know, they don't represent the population in Yemen.
Thank you both for that. And so I think we've laid out like a sort of a baseline understanding of like what is going on now. But I also want to talk about sort of more broadly about Yemeni society in this current moment, because the whole world has seen like these massive protests in Sana'a, like in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And Jihan, if it's okay, I'll field this question to you. How do people in Yemen generally understand their relationship to what's happening right now in Gaza?
You know, I remember growing up, you know, because I visited Yemen every year as a child in the summertime. And I remember as a child in the streets chanting in Arabic about a free Palestine, about a liberation that is tied. And we're not free until Palestine is free. And I remember even my grandmother, may she rest in peace, you know, and I still know the chant right now, but it's too long and it's in Arabic. I may share it one day on our page, but it's so beautiful. And it talks about it talks about resistance, and it talks about freedom, and it talks about liberation, and it talks about Arab identity. So, you know, the plight of Palestinians has been a concern for all Arabs and Muslims. And I think right now, finally, the rest of the world is seeing how important and valuable the lives of Palestinians are. I think they've been humanized in a way that we've never seen before. Especially if you remember Khaled, the grandfather, who was sadly carrying his granddaughter and calling her the soul of his soul, Ruh al-Ruh. So, you know, the solidarity between Yemen and Palestine is, you know, rooted in our shared identity, in our shared history, and it supersedes this moment. It's been, you know, the plight of Palestine has been ever since the inception of Israel as a settler colony. It's a very old one. And, you know, people marching, Yemenis marching in the streets is also, it's been since forever. As long as I've known, for decades, I've been calling for a Palestine free from apartheid, from occupation, from Zionism. So I like that the world is like looking at Yemen and commending Yemen for their bravery, even though they have so much to lose. I will say the one thing that I think continues to be lost during this moment of, you know, intersectionality and solidarity is people continue to not see the plight of Yemenis who are losing everything. And they're hardly reconstructing their lives and infrastructure after a brutal 8-year war led by the U.S. and the U.K., who are bombing them right now, right? And the blockade, right? Let's not forget the Saudi-imposed blockade that's been on and off until this day. So they are starving. Sorry, let me correct myself. They are being starved. The bombing has just been halted. The Saudi-led bombing, the U.S. and the U.K. bombing is continuing right now illegally, but they're dealing with all of that, and they're still rising up for the sake of Palestine. And I really hope that the globe can see not only their efforts, but also their suffering.
Thank you. You are listening to Code Pink Radio, coming to you through Pacifica Radio's WPFW in Washington, D.C., WBAI in New York City, KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. We'll be right back after this break with Shireen, Aisha, and Jihan to talk more about Yemen.
was Oud Improvisation by Mohamed Abu Zakri, and you can learn more about Yemeni music and our Beyond the War Yemeni concert episode. So I encourage you all to check it out.
Welcome back. I'm Danica with Code Pink. You're listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. And we're back. We're talking about background of Yemen, what the last 9 years has looked like. So Biden just added Ansarullah back to not the foreign terrorist organization list, but a different specially designated terrorist list. It was, there's some acronym for it. I don't know it off the top of my head. But this was a list that President Donald Trump added Ansarullah to towards the end of his term. Is it, I'm saying that right? Yeah, it was like towards the end of his term, which made it incredibly difficult to get really necessary humanitarian aid into Yemen, and then a whole host of other issues. Biden and like all of you were part of the effort to get Biden to stop the U.S. role in Yemen, and then also remove Ansarullah from the terrorist list so that humanitarian aid could flow back into Yemen. So he did remove them from the terrorist list, but now he has added them back to it. And like Shireen mentioned earlier, there's, you know, this just sort of mindless and thoughtless pairing between the Houthis and Iran, and like that's sort of the talking point they're using right now. Both, you know, Israeli officials when they talk about the Houthis and U.S. officials. And Shireen, I feel like you're always good at answering this question. What is the deal with that? Where is that coming from? How can it be characterized to people who may just be like just getting their feet wet in this topic?
So this relationship with Iran. The relationship was first established by Ali Abdullah Saleh when he was trying to recruit the U.S. to help him in his fight against the Houthis in the early 2000s. And for those of you who want to go through the rabbit hole of WikiLeaks, be my guest, because that's what I did and it was very informative. But he asked, so he already had the Saudi support saying, look, these guys are at your border, they hate you, help me fight them. And the Saudis naively agreed and they lost all of the wars with the Houthis. He also then tried to get US support for the war against the Houthis in his local battle with them. And he was a very, you know, he knew what he was doing in the region. Like he was a very great at manipulation. He knew what everybody wanted to hear, what their weak points were. And he knew the Iran would be a good, you know, motivating factor for the US to get involved. And so he said, look, they're getting their weapons from Iran, which means you need to get involved. The US ambassador at the time, as well as a couple of Republican senators in the US, decided to take this very seriously. And they did their own investigation and they found out that all of the weapons that the Houthis were getting at the time were from the Yemeni black market. So they're like, actually, the weapons are yours and we're not getting involved. But the idea stuck that these guys were funded and supported, and not just that, but like proxies of Iran. And Saudi ran with it during their war with the Houthis because it makes it appears like they're fighting equals when they're saying that they are fighting Iran, but it was really an asymmetrical war. I mean, you're fighting a group that didn't have an air force or a navy, and so the Saudis didn't want to admit that those were their foes. So it was easier to say that Iran's influence in the region is growing, and so we're fighting Iran in the region, and they blew that relationship out of proportion. Now, you know, there's that Streisand effect, right? You want something not to happen and then it ends up happening even more. And so their relationship with Iran, in fact, did grow over the last several years when they found themselves surrounded by their own neighbors and bombed and blockaded by their own neighbors, except for countries like Iran. And so they did forge an alliance with Iran. Iran, of course, does support them, maybe monetarily, maybe through some technology transfers, but not to the same degree that people imagine. They couldn't have supported them with weapons given the blockade, naval, sea, you know, naval, land, and air blockade that was imposed on Yemen for several years. And as we can see right now, the US is still patrolling Yemeni waters. And so the idea that Iran is just coming in and out of Yemen and dropping these weapons, it's just a It's a preposterous, you know, argument, and it's just not based on any evidence, if any at all. And so, yes, they have a relationship with Iran. It's a positive relationship with Iran, but it's not to the extent that the U.S. imagines, or at least U.S. media expresses to its population. Now, one thing to realize also that we've been conditioned in the West to think of Iran as the enemy. So to say Iran-backed Houthis is just a very quick euphemism for saying enemy bad guys. The British do it too. If you hear about, you know, the group that was that targeted U.S. servicemen right now in either Syria or Jordan, I'm not quite sure if they figured it out yet, but, you know, they'll say Iran-backed Iraqi resistance, right? Iran-backed Houthis, Iran-backed Hezbollah. So whoever attacks them in the region, they always like to emphasize their relationship with Iran. Whether that relationship is significant or not does not seem to matter.
Thank you. So after 2015, I think we've covered a lot of pieces of it, but generally, you know, all three of you have kind of talked about it, like, Saudi Arabia and the UAE wanted sort of a puppet government type of situation in Yemen to control the Bab al-Mandeb Strait because of trade, et cetera, et cetera. And now the U.S. is bombing Yemen, presumably over trade and to protect a genocide and do political cover for genocide again. And Yemen has been bombed by, I think, four consecutive presidents. Is it more? Yeah, it's four. Okay. And the war that started, the war on Yemen that started in 2015, created the world's worst humanitarian crisis. So I do want to talk a little bit about that. And I think we've, you know, covered how it started a little bit. But I was wondering, Aisha, if you'd be able to tell us a little bit more and give us more context to the humanitarian crisis that ensued during those 9 years and then afterwards.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for asking that. Because as Jihan said, Yemen has been experiencing the largest humanitarian crisis that actually is man-made. It's not due to natural disasters. There are at least today over 17 million people who are at stage three or four of food insecurity, which means a level, either emergency or crisis level. What that means is at least 25% of the population are in, they go at night or during the day without a meal a day. It also means that you're gonna have one person out of every 10,000 people die every day of hunger. So those statistics are actually quite disturbing. The second thing also is that we have half Yemeni children are suffering malnutrition, acute malnutrition. A lot of mothers also are malnourished and also giving birth to babies who are malnourished. So the consequences of the severe malnutrition in Yemen are severe because they also affect the cognitive development of children. So Yemen will be having to deal with this for a very long time. We talked a little bit about the blockade on Yemen. The blockade on Yemen actually still exists. It has not been lifted. A few of the restrictions have been lifted, including allowing more fuel to come in and allowing more food to come in, but still it's not allowing all the medicine to come in, for example. I know that they needed to buy medicine for kidney patients, especially for dialysis, and they weren't able, the government somehow wasn't able to buy it. And so they decided to buy it through Aden Port. When it got into Aden Port, and the internationally recognized government realized it's for the Ministry of Health in Sana'a, they actually auctioned the medicine. And that wasn't auctioned, just they allowed it to expire at the port. And in turn, a lot of patients in Yemen who needed the medicine suffered or died. Same thing if we talk about cancer patients. There are at least 400,000 people in Yemen who have died. This is by the end of 2022, according to UN reports. These estimates say that the majority of them died of infectious diseases and other causes other than direct, military, for direct military reasons. I, as an epidemiologist, I'm going to have to say that these are extremely underestimate, even the 400,000, because the Yemeni population is all over high mountains that are hard to reach because that's where we work. It takes our team sometimes 9 to 16 hours to reach some of these places that are scattered on mountains. So there are a lot of people who are dying in these places then that nobody's counting them. Save the Children said that every 10 minutes a child in Yemen dies of infectious diseases. So if you look at it from any aspect, whether, you know, Yemen experienced the largest cholera outbreak recorded in history, diphtheria, Yemen had not had diphtheria since 1980. And now diphtheria has been raging in Yemen for the last 4 or 5 years. Dengue is now all over Yemen, even in areas that are mountainous, where, you know, the mosquito doesn't live. But now, because of global warming, even mountainous regions have dengue. And dengue is very dangerous because there are 4 serotypes. And if you get one, the second time you get dengue, you get a severe case of dengue. And Yemen has already all the 4 serotypes in Yemen. So however you look at it, Yemen is struggling and is suffering. The destruction of the economy is purposeful. The UN, High Commission for Yemen, Liz Grande, when she testified in Congress, in the Senate, she did say that the Saudi-led coalition is purposefully destroying Yemen's economy. The servants, civil servants in Yemen, who are especially in the north, have not been paid salaries since 2016. And that is extremely challenging. You know, you have medical doctors, you have professors at universities who've sold everything they have, including their books, their cars, their furniture, just to feed their families. So that's a systematic destruction of the Yemeni economy in order to induce famine in Yemen. We've also seen reports that are credible that shows the Saudi-led coalition with the Emirates, with the U.S. support, purposefully targeted food supplies in Yemen. So every chicken hatchery, every chicken farm, anything that grows food locally, they targeted that. So I hope one day we can take them actually to the International Court of Justice and charge them with inducing famine and for the hundreds of thousands of people they killed in Yemen.
Thank you, Aisha. And I remember, I met all three of you through this work, and I, watched the three of you sort of lead the movement in the U.S. and I think Shereen, I met you in 2018, and it was, a room full of people at Loyola University in Chicago who had no idea the U.S. was involved in Yemen at all. No clue. No one had any idea. And then there was a protest the following day. I think it was about Syria, but I don't think it was Yemen centered, but Shereen did get to bring up Yemen. To this large group of people, and it was again some people's first time hearing about it. And since then, a lot of shifts have been made by politicians in the U.S. and in Congress. And Jahan, can you tell us a little bit and tell the listeners how that movement went in the U.S. and how people sort of resisted U.S. involvement in the war?
Yes, actually, that's how myself, Dr. Aisha, and Dr. Shireen met. I think we were all doing our thing individually on a social media. And we never had an entity or a group to really lead, this charge. you know, I think a lot of us community organizers, I'm a community organizer by trade, and, you know, we work on so many different policies. But like you said, I'm like the only Yemeni that my comrades know, you know, and anytime anything has to do with Yemen, they'll contact me, you know. And that showed that there was such a disparity, you know, there wasn't anything that really represents our voice or our struggle. And that's when I started the Yemeni Alliance Committee. It was right after the Muslim ban was in place, and, you know, I was from the Bay Area, and I was like, let me just be that little train that could. Let me just see what I can do, you know what I mean? And then I started this group, volunteer group. We're still a volunteer group. And we began lobbying with our local Bay Area lawmakers, so senators and representatives. We started this initially in the very beginning of 2016. And we learned very quickly that even lawmakers didn't know where Yemen was. So it's not just your everyday organizers that didn't know. So then I started to bring the map of Yemen, and then would almost give like a little history lesson of like, this is where Yemen is, and this is what the population. Another question was like, oh, this is just like a little country in the Middle East that we only heard of on the show Friends one time when Chandler was in the airport or whatever, you know? And then it's like, yeah, we have 30 million, a population of 30 million people. And people are like, whoa. That's a lot of people. So it took a lot of work to kind of get Yemen at the forefront. And it's still not. It's still not at the forefront of any of our lawmakers' minds, unless it has to do with trade. And that's why we're seeing the U.S. Escalating violence and intervening and also defending Israel. But so it started really slow. And then, like I said, myself, Dr. Aisha, and Dr. Shireen sort of like started talking online, messaging each other. And of course, we were really careful and hesitant because, you know, one thing that you'll probably hear me say a lot is that not all skin folks are kin folks. So that really means that, you know, like any other community that is impacted by colonization, militarization, war, you're going to find people of that native land that are also part of warmongering or war profiteering, and Yemen is no different. There are a lot of Yemenis in the diaspora that are pro-war or that receive some kind of profit or benefit from promoting the war, whether it's humanitarian NGOs, whether they're reporters. And to be honest with you, while the three of us have a lot of trolls, I think our biggest hurdle is other Yemenis in the diaspora that talk about Yemen in a way that justifies the war, justifies the blockade. So there's just a lot of hurdles, right? But I think that we have done amazing, just the three of us, and our comrades, of course, you guys at Code Pink, FCNO, Action Corps. We have so many friends in the organizing community, and we collectively have made Yemen important. And then we have some lawmakers who are friends as well, like Ro Khanna, who in collaboration with him worked on pushing the very first War Powers Resolution, which passed in 2019 through both chambers. It was bipartisan, but of course, Trump vetoed it. And since we have a legacy of endless wars and war profiteering, it's easy to understand how these measures failed. Unfortunately, we're still pushing this initiative as we speak right now, because the War Powers Resolution will essentially should check the presidential power that he, you know, whether it's Biden or whoever's in power, is going to abuse. And I think we understand that it's not who's in power, it's the system that has allowed the American foreign policy to just be militarization. That's the only answer. You know, America has militarized every aspect of its foreign policy since 9/11. And it's not just the war on Yemen. That the current one, I mean, even if we go back to post 9/11 and the war on terror, which we know that it's still routinely in place, routine drone strikes, unmanned drones attacking Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, that's still in place, detaining Yemenis. Guantanamo Bay is how I got into this, actually. We know that's still open. It's been like a long battle to try to make Yemen mainstream And I think that we have done amazing work with all of our colleagues and comrades, but still people don't know. Right now, what they know about Yemen is there's a handsome pirate who's on some kind of
That
dinghy, you know what I mean?
poor kid.
So, while they're trying to defend the safety of Palestinians, they're being fetishized. And that's kind of gross. But, I think I just want to really just emphasize that the people of Yemen, it's a sovereign country. No other nation or power has authority to control its territory, its land, or its government. And I think that's why the world is like really peed off, because our history has not allowed for occupation or invasion. Like, we don't take kindly to outsiders coming in. And now we hear that there are boots on the ground. But it's I will say, I will end on this, that I think why it should matter to fellow organizers who are working on so many things right now, because I know there's so many wars, war on black brown people, war on black people, war on migration, the right to move. But the war on Yemen is important because it is an American war. Like, our tax dollars are not only supporting and funding this war, but they're also profiting. There's a lot of like back end interest. So it's definitely an American problem. It's not something that's happening all the way over there to some Arabs or Muslims. It's happening all the way over there to Arabs and Muslims because our taxpayers are allowing it to happen. So I strongly suggest for my organizer comrades to get involved and, add in Yemen, integrate it into your organizing.
Thank you. And I'm going to include all the guests at and organizations in the description of this video and wherever it's posted on social media. We had a question about British colonization, but I do feel like that might need a whole entire episode. Also, I think Shireen kind of co covered that in her. Yeah, you did. You covered it in your presentation in 2018, and that whole thing's on YouTube, so maybe I'll link that as well. Just people could see the parallels between now and 2018. It might make you feel really crazy. But I want to thank you all so much for coming on, and I want to give the opportunity to you all if you have anything to add or any final thoughts at all. Keep a lookout for Yemeni Alliance Committee and any other collaborating organizations for upcoming actions, because I'm sure there will be plenty.
Yeah, and just to echo what Jihan ended on, the US and fellow Americans might not know that this is their war, but certainly Yemenis know who's been bombing them for the past 9 years, whether it was American bombs landing, that were dropped by the Saudis or the UAE, or now American bombs being dropped by the Americans themselves. It's always been clear who's been bombing them and who's, underdeveloped them and repressed them for so many years. And so I think that's another reason why this absolutely matters. This is not just, and Yemen poses no threat to the United States, and yet the United States feels like it has to be, playing cowboys and police and, supporting a genocide in Yemeni waters. And so I think it's really important for us to resist continued US interference and intervention in wars and in countries that it has no business, controlling or bombing.
Yeah, I'd also support what Jihan and Dr. Aladini said. Basically, when we read in the media terminology like the US hit Houthi targets, they're not actually hitting Houthi targets. They're hitting Yemeni cities, they're hitting Yemeni airports, they're hitting Yemeni seaports, they're terrorizing the Yemeni population. So I think even in our advocacy, we need to be very aware of the language that's used to describe the aggression on the Yemeni people.
Thank you all. I would end by just requesting for listeners to get to know fellow Yemenis. We're everywhere. While we're concentrated in California and Michigan and New York, but you'll find us everywhere. And I think that as organizers, we know that we have to center those that are directly impacted by these things. So I strongly encourage folks to invite a Yemeni, And learn about not just the impact of war, but just about culture. Because I think the constant dehumanization of Arabs and Muslims on a historical level for decades is what has allowed these wars to go, concealed and sort of just dismissed, because there's this long vilification of Arabs and Muslims. We don't.
Please follow Yemen Relief and Reconstruction Foundation and Yemeni Alliance Committee. Yemen Source is also a really great Twitter account to follow. And with that, we're going to end. And thank you so much to our guests. And thank you for listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say cold war,
we say cold pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say cold war,
we say cold pink.
Cold pink for freedom.
Was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say cold terror,
we say cold pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say cold terror,
we say cold pink.
Cold pink for freedom. Cold pink for peace. Cold pink till hunger and war have ceased. Cold pink for women, boys, men, and girls. Together we'll
our phones and the places we meet. They curtail our speech, our movement,